Acts chapter 12. It was about this time that King Herod arrested some who belonged to the church, intending to persecute them. He had James, the brother of John, put to death with the sword. When he saw that this pleased the Jews, he had proceeded to seize Peter also. This happened during the Feast of Unleavened Bread. After arresting him, he put him in prison, handing him over to be guarded by four squads of four soldiers each. Herod, intending to bring him out for public trial after the Passover. So Peter was kept in prison, but the church was earnestly praying to God for him. The night before Herod was going to bring him to trial, Peter was sleeping between two soldiers, bound with two chains, and sentries stood guard at the entrance. Suddenly, an angel of the Lord appeared, and a light shone in the cell. He struck Peter on one side and woke him up. "Quick, get up," he said, and the chains fell off Peter's wrists. Then the angel said to him, "Put on your clothes and sandals." And Peter did so. "Wrap your cloak around you and follow me," the angel told him. Peter followed him out of the prison, but he had no idea what the angel was doing and what was really happening. He thought he was seeing a vision. They passed the first and second guards and came to the iron gate leading to the city. It opened for them by itself, and they went through it. When they had walked the length of one street, suddenly the angel left him. Then Peter came to himself and said, "Now I know without a doubt that the Lord sent this angel and rescued me from Herod's clutches and from everything the Jewish people were anticipating." When this had dawned on him, he went to the house of Mary, the mother of John, also called Mark, where many people had gathered and were praying. Peter knocked at the outer entrance, and a servant girl named Rhoda came to answer the door. When she recognized Peter's voice, she was so overjoyed that she ran back without opening it and exclaimed, "Peter is at the door." "You're out of your mind," they told her. When she kept insisting that it was so, they said, "It must be his angel." But Peter kept on knocking, and when they opened the door and saw him, they were astonished. Peter motioned with his hand for them to be quiet and described how the Lord had brought him out of prison. Tell James and the brothers about this," he said, and then he left for another place. In the morning, there was no small commotion among the soldiers as to what had become of Peter. After Herod had made a thorough search for him and did not find him, he cross-examined the guards and ordered that they be executed. Then Herod went from Judea to Caesarea, and he stayed there for a while. He had been quarreling with the other people of Tyre and Sidon. They now joined him together and sought an audience with him. Having secured the support of Blastus, a trusted personal servant of the king, they asked for peace because they depended on the king's country for their food supply. On the appointed day, Herod, wearing his royal robes, sat on his throne and delivered a public address to the people. They shouted, "This is the voice of a god, not a man." Immediately, because Herod did not give praise to God, an angel of the Lord struck him down, and he was eaten by worms and died. But the word of God continued to increase to be spread. When Barnabas and Saul had finished their mission, they returned from Jerusalem, taking with them John, also called Mark.
Well, thank you very much for taking a reading there on Acts chapter 12. Are there any observations of the chapter before we start into things?
Well, I have no questions, but I was just wondering if the set day that Herod went out on, it sounds like it was a gathering of the whole community, which would indicate perhaps an appointed time, which
the last
I haven't...
Last day of the day of
Because of the first section of, So that's really interesting that he would do that. He's like a picture of an anti-Messiah almost. Yeah.
We're gonna get to that in a short order. Any other comments or observations? Well, one of the things that would be good to kind of keep in mind here is that we see lots of Herods throughout the Bible, and just to keep kind of track on which Herod we're referring to in this point, this particular Herod is known as Herod Agrippa, often known as Herod Agrippa the First. Lived 11 B.C. to 44 A.D. is kind of what he's thought to reign and reign from 41 to 44. So we're kind of in that time frame there. And to remember that in the book of Acts, as we've been reading in some of the accounts there in the Judges and such, some of the events kind of jump around a little bit. Acts is ordered a little bit thematically, although it is somewhat chronological as you see the growth of the believers, Messiah. But some of the things that we see there, especially as we're seeing these jump forward and flashbacks regarding this great vision that we talked about that Peter had, and we read about that in Acts chapter 11, some of these things are going on at the same time. But keep in mind here what they're talking about, this persecution, because, one of the things that you see right at the beginning of the chapter is it talks about James or Yaakov there, the brother of Yochanan, put to death with the sword. So various people have wondered who that was. One of the ideas that some people have brought forward is that this is one of the brothers of Zebedee, or I should say the sons of Zebedee, that we saw earlier on. And this being potentially the leader of the Jerusalem Council that we see at the time. So you kind of get the idea that there was some bit of jumping around, because we'll read in Acts chapter 15 that he's presiding. So kind of a hard to be beheaded and also presiding at the same time. So that's one thing that we see in that case. Yes?
I was just doing a quick reading. You have two different major people named James at that time period. You have James, the son of Zebedee, then you have James, who is referred to as the brother of the Lord.
Yes. Yeah, so you do have these two leaders, because Yaakov is a very common name. Also, Yeshua, or Yehoshua, was also a common name of the period as well. So those are things to keep in mind in that case as well. But one of the things that in reference to, we're talking about which appointed time are we talking about, Josephus records a similar downfall of this particular Herod and said that he lived age 53. So you see that from 11 B.C. to 44 A.D. is 53 years. So he definitely was dying at about the same time period. And when you read the account of what Josephus has, there's a lot of parallels in here for what we see here, and basically proclaiming himself to be God there. And as we'll take a look at a little bit more as we get into this chapter, proclaiming himself to be God was quite amazing, especially if you see the time frame of unleavened bread and the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the 7 days there. So one of the things that we look at here as we start out is it was during the days of unleavened bread. Now, you see a kind of a quick progression of things in this chapter as it starts out that they verse 1, that Herod the king laid hands on some who belonged to the assembly in order to mistreat them, and he had Yaakov, the brother of Yochanan, put to death with a sword. Now, some of the things that are recorded down through time of ways that people were executed and some of which is recorded in the Sanhedrin, dating way back. You've got stoning, burning, killing with the sword, beheading, and strangling. So some of these things were for different offenses, so one of the things that we can see as to what was being charged against Yaakov in this case, being killed by the sword, was something very heinous crime there, probably on terms with blasphemy. Well, should that really surprise us, seeing the way that that Peter was treated there, and Peter and John were also treated there at the beginning. We've already read about that. So that kind of chastisement and persecution was certainly quite consistent with what we've seen so far. Yes, Tammy.
It shows you that they were just using any excuse to kill these people. Otherwise, there would have been a consistent mode of execution. So whenever they bring somebody in, they find any excuse they could find to kill them. So they were charging them with whatever they could. Otherwise, you would see if they were being charged with one crime, if every person that was being brought in was being charged with the exact same crime, there would have been the exact same mode of execution.
Yeah, stoning with Stephen, killing by the sword with Yaakov here.
Yeah. Incongruity here, because then in the next section you've got Herod proclaiming himself to be God.
Yes.
You know, so really, but of course he was in a position of power. So it seems to me there was definitely an agenda towards the Messiah believers.
Well, yeah.
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 Herod could get away with it.
Yes.
Of course, you know, not with the Lord, but obviously the Sadducees and the Pharisees. And his predecessor, Herod the Great, was actually, had been the, some of the Pharisees had actually suggested that he was a Messiah because of his rebuilding and readornment of the temple.
Yeah, Antipas was no great, lovely king either. Of course, there's a wild progression of those folks sliding downhill in that case. But it's really interesting. You're talking about this, we're talking about rush to judgment. And here we have another situation where they could not wait. They wanted to haul in these leaders and off them, execute them, here before the end of the festival. You're like, what is the hurry? Why the rush? I mean, look at how many trials we've seen so far here. We saw the trial of Yeshua. That was a rush, we call it kangaroo court. We saw the trial of Stephen. Also, there was a ramrodding of Peter and John. So it's definitely a consistent theme of just rushing people through to get rid of them. And when we see what the fate of Yohanan, the baptizer, he also was off pretty quickly to deal with a very inconvenient message that he was bringing forward as well.
Jeff, do you think that we know from Josephus that various Jews with a message to bring to the people use the festivals to expound whatever their beliefs were? Do you think that the disciples of Yeshua were doing similarly, continued to do, you know, because it's later now. Is this 40-something?
I mean, if this is the time period, we're saying like at that time, so it kind of brings it, since it's kind of connected there with the first, the chapters that were right before that in Acts 10 and 11.
Yeah.
You're seeing a time period where they've had some sort of meeting, you know, perhaps maybe even the Jerusalem Council that we read about in Acts 15 has already happened.
Right.
It could have already happened by that time.
Right.
So, yeah, if you're talking about in the 40s, that's good grief. It's 10 years,
exactly.
Maybe 15 years
so
later.
So possibly, well, the last 14 or 15 years, the believing disciples, the apostles, have been using the festivals as occasions for disseminating the gospel.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think
it would appear that, wouldn't it?
That's 45 major opportunities.
Right.
45 major opportunities. Yeah. It's like, oh, good grief. Here are these guys coming again. They're here again.
Right.
And when they were hanging out in the temple there for quite a while before they were thrown out.
You have Jews from all over the diaspora in Jerusalem. So it's no wonder then that you have congregations in Rome, in Spain, many, and all over the diaspora. You had people have been hearing the message then, haven't they, for 15 years or more. Amazing. I never thought about that before. Yeah.
Well, I mean, if you think about it and you look at how the festivals were very instrumental in the rebuilding of Israel after the Babylonian exile, that was a great thing because you bring in all the people together and then you're going to then teach them something that they hadn't heard for a long, long time, probably not even in their lifetime. And certainly not on a grand scale for hundreds of years. So the festivals, as you can see, were instrumental in all throughout Israel's history and even up into what time period that people think that the festivals stopped becoming relevant. Well, here are 15 years going. They're very relevant and they were very important for the spreading of the good news to the whole world. So that's one of the interesting things there. Now, as we've talked about before with this idea of the festivals also have all the symbols involved with this. And one of the things we just got done studying, Richard did a great thing on unleavened bread, but here it comes up again. So it's always, we can never hear about the lessons of God too often, so here it comes up again. And it's quite... quite a great conjunction that we have here talking about unleavened bread as we as a country celebrate independence and celebrate what we call about the idea of freedom. Now, as we talk about this idea of unleavened bread, it's a very interesting connection that comes down through time, and even our founding fathers saw this. What is the connection between unleavened bread and liberty? What was that?
The first thing that came to mind was freedom from sin.
Okay. Freedom from sin. Because what is unleavened bread? Where do we first see that? Show it.
Okay. Freedom from being under the oppression of not only the leadership, but also from sins and transgressions. Because the sin and transgression is a burden upon you, pressure on you. But you'd be free from that as well. Unleavened bread has those two pictures. You're free from one thing, but later you're also free from the sins that have been put upon you. But you learn.
Still free.
Well, in the same way that the Egyptians were laboring under Pharaoh and being slaves and paying taxes, so America was under the British Crown, slaving and working and paying taxes to Britain. And that's what the independence was all about, really. And I join with you.
Well, because one of the things that that we get out of the great things we see in the Liberty Bell, since it takes a passage there from the Torah itself about proclaiming liberty throughout the land, and that being related to the Jubilee and the idea of a discharging of debts, discharging of obligations, things that are chalked up against you, and resetting things back to a status on that. Here we have the idea of liberty. Now, one of the things that you also hear about in the, I always talk about the founding fathers, is the concept of building something where you have a set of directives. We call it the Constitution, and also the supporting document to that, the Declaration of Independence. Now, going forward with that is the idea that you have a system based on law, that this is the way things go. Now, one thing that they also talked about is that a system like this is based upon freedom, restraining the government from going after you. Now, in the sense, it also requires you to govern yourself. So that means that it's not the law, it's you. And also, as we see there, what God's teaching is that He wants to write His laws upon our hearts so they come out of our hearts instead of out of the end of a sword or a gun or handcuffs or whatever.
Oh, I was just going to say that one of the similarities that I saw was that they were both annual reminders.
Yes. Hardly anyone seems to think that the 4th of July is obsolete and irrelevant, except if you forget the idea of independence and the idea of liberty in that regard. Now, it brings us to this idea of what Yaakov writes in his letter, that he says, when you look into the law of liberty. Now, we know what law he was talking about. It's the law of God. Now, that brings up the thing that Paul goes on at great length, is this great dichotomy. The dichotomy, or the problem that you have with these two sorts of things. It almost seems like a paradox, where you've got two teachings that seem to be contradicting themselves, but they work well together. The idea of the law bringing liberty, but then the law bringing death. And we were just talking about that with Richard here recently, about the law bringing death. Because under that, violation of that brings God's judgment. You're working outside of God's framework when you work outside of what He wants you to do. Now, in a sense, though, the law of liberty, how is it a law of liberty, though? How is that which brings you death also that which brings you liberty?
As a just a thought of that, both principles of liberty, as well as, you know, the days of loaves and bread and the connection between them, and of course how Peter got out, both events, concepts, is designed for the person who is observing to identify that which must be liberated from. Mm-hmm. You, in unleavened bread, you identify that which is unacceptable, that is intolerable, unclean, unholy.
Fermented, sour, rotten.
Exactly. And liberty is the same exact principle, in that you identify that which must be liberated from, things that are unacceptable, things that are unacceptable not only to you personally, but also to God in particular, and which I think is one of the reasons why Herod chose such a wonderful holy day to try to attempt to exact retribution on to Peter, because as far as he was concerned, he identified something that was evil or corrupt. And of course, God then, by all accounts, identified him being the one who was actually evil and corrupt. But they go hand in hand because the concept is the same. Both processes, you must identify that which is unacceptable.
Yeah, because otherwise, otherwise you end up with a situation of like, 11? Well, I don't see any 11, right? Then?
Well, probably a little more simpler approach would be, you know, when you observe the law and live in it and by it, you are free from the death sentence of breaking the law. So it works for you as well as against you. You break the law, you're going to have to pay by death. And that's where Christ came in. He paid the ultimate price of death for us at the cross. And we're free from the death penalty when we do break the law. When we observe it especially, we're free from that penalty. And it gives us liberty.
Very interesting. Because one of the things that you're looking at there is the law brings you death if you break it. And, you know, as it's been brought up by all the prophets and such like that, is that there's no unrighteous, not even one, unless those that God designates as righteous. As we talked about this before, with this idea of being declared, basically being declared righteous. That's why you can have what another seems like a paradox, where you have people who are have foibles, they can be enticed and dragged away into sin, yet they can be declared righteous. But that righteousness doesn't come from who you are. It comes from who He is and the fact that He wants to grant mercy. And the way He grants mercy, as He talked about it, is through Messiah. Yes?
One thing that is forgotten or put on the wayside, even though we're forgiven the penalty of death, we still will suffer circumstances by our sin and the law that we have broken.
Yep.
That we will suffer still, but we are free from the death which Christ paid for us.
Yeah, because you don't have a idea of just a... You do something and God will discharge things out to the point where you have no problems anymore. Unfortunately, some people think that when they accept God, get reconciled to God, that everything goes well. And that whatever the baggage they had before doesn't come along. Now, the point in that is that we have freedom from the guilt of all that, that weight of rebellion against God. We're now reconciled with God again. And we also have a way of dealing with the past and dealing with the present. Because we have hope. And hope is one of the most wonderful things to have. Because if you're in a time period where you don't have much hope, whether you're in an economic situation like we have here in this country right now, or whether you're in prison, like what we were seeing here with Peter, what is your vision? Do you see yourself in being in a lost cause? Or do you see yourself being in the presence of God? And many people throughout time, suffering horrific persecution, in the midst of that, have recognized and God has given them the revelation that they are in the presence of God. And that is just a marvelous thing and has allowed people to, there's the accounts of martyrs singing at their executions, being joyful that they were considered worthy for persecution under the name. And that sort of peace, that sort of well-being can only come when you have hope. And which brings us to the idea of the unleavened bread part. As we were talking about, one big thing of unleavened bread is identifying the things that need to get out. And we come through on these various words that we've learned here before. Just a little bit of a refresher here. With chametz, the idea of chametz, we've talked about this. The idea of sourness is where the root of that goes. Chometz is another form of that, and you see it referred to in the realm of vinegar, something that's sour, rotten, and that kind of thing. Seor, these two words are often together, and often in English you see them just translated leaven, but like for example in Exodus 12 and 13, these two words are used together. Seor and chometz are used together. Seor is basically the stuff that's left over that's chometz. So you kind of get this idea that there's something that's sour, then there's the remnants of stuff laying around that's sour to get out. The idea of... I like it there in Exodus 12:15, where it talks about not getting the stuff out of your land. In Hebrew, it talks about... It actually uses the form of Shabbat. You cease it in your land. And in the Septuagint version... talks about destroy it. You cease it, you destroy it. But in a sense, we have to recognize it first. Which gets us to a passage that we've looked at before, but it's always good to get a reminder of that. And that's in 1 Corinthians chapter 5. And starting in verse 6, 6 through 8. Your boasting is not good. You do not know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump of dough. Clean out the old leaven so that you may be a new lump, just as you are in fact unleavened. For Christ our Passover has been sacrificed. Therefore, let us keep the feast, not with old leaven, nor with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the leavened bread of sincerity and truth. It's one of those great points of that is that to recognize, you know, Paul uses this idea of malice and wickedness. Wickedness is that form of just going against God's instructions and that kind of thing. And malice kicks it up another notch where you are actually having intent to harm. So
I had one more thought to finish up our last thought about death and liberty. The word grace in the Christian realm has been grossly misunderstood or misinterpreted. Grace is favor, but the only way you have favor is by living out His law, living Torah. When you're doing that, you have His favor. It's not by sinning and getting grace. There is mercy, yes, but the grace is favor, and your favor, again, is when you're living right before God. That's where you get His true grace or His true favor. It's not sin and Him forgiving you getting grace.
Yeah, that's been taken to the extreme by some people, but it's basically the idea of the Rasputin principle. You know, we keep on sinning so that grace may abound. You know, Paul talked about that in Romans as well. God forbid. You don't do that, because why don't you do that? If the point of what you're getting out of your life is malice and wickedness, why would you want that back in your life? If God is identifying these things and says, get rid of it, get it out of your life, why do you want it back in your life again? And this is one of the common terms, zoume, in Greek that we see throughout most of where you see the idea of leaven and sourness there in the New Testament and also in the Septuagint, like in Exodus chapter 12, this zoume is used a lot, and azoume, just with a meaning against or opposite, without, that kind of thing. So without zoume, it's unleavened. And zoume, the idea of getting it out of the congregation of God. Now, when we get this idea of getting stuff out, we saw this dichotomy here of where you are having Herod potentially wanting to use the unleavened bread thing. We saw that with the trial of Yeshua, that this was also a time period where they tried to get the bad people out. In that case, it was customarily done there at Passover to decide. Now, one of the things I always remember when you see references in the first century to Passover, it became the generic all-encompassing term for Passover and unleavened bread. So it's not just the day, but also the whole Passover and unleavened bread. So the idea of trying major criminals and getting rid of them at Passover was something that we saw before. So this idea of wanting to purge out what was considered leaven, in this case, you have this idea of malice being brought against the working of God. Because one of the things that we had seen there earlier in the book of Acts is how the movement of God had been going through the believers in Messiah. We saw that with what happened there at Shavuot, Pentecost in the temple, that great movement. We saw these great miracles and things that have been happening through the apostles. Now this is potentially 15 years later where this stuff has been happening primarily within the land of Israel and just the short environs around there. These things have been happening for 15 years. Potentially 45 different festivals that people have been hearing about this. And so now you had this move to purge out what was thought to be leavened by the authorities of the time period. Now, just as the lesson of the Lamb of God being led to the slaughter, there is prophesied in Isaiah 53, that was coincided with the Lamb-centric appointment at Passover. Thus, you have this idea of the puffing up. This is not just something that Paul created. This concept of puffing up in connection with leaven, chametz, is well documented if you look throughout the Talmud. This idea, that was a common concept of what the lesson of chametz was about, even there in the first century. So this was not a foreign concept, that this is something, you're not just getting little crumbs out of your house. This is something that's happening in you going forward. Again, you can say, well, if this was extended to unleavened bread, meaning something that's happening in your heart, some sort of spiritual thing that's happening along with the physical thing that's happening, then you might ask, well, why wasn't the connection made between lamb and something that would come forward? We see later on, hundreds of years later, that connection was made, that Messiah would have suffering. And even if you see there's a few writings among some of the sages that the Messiah would suffer. And some of those have been discovered recently there. Some of the writings referring to the belief, even in the first century, perhaps even with the sect that's called the Essenes, that there would be a suffering component to Messiah as well. So these kinds of connections between the appointed times and things that God was doing actually in people's lives was clearly established down through time. So then we have this idea of the sourness, the stuff that's left over, that's fermented. And it's interesting that in this, we also have a kind of an interesting connection in what some of the people in the first few centuries before the first century, when they were working on the translation of the Septuagint, were using, and some of their word choices that they were using. One of the things that came through there is that in some of the cases where you have chometz, meaning that you see there in like Proverbs and Psalms and the prophets, they would apply this chometz to a spiritual situation, like a they would call it bitterness, stuff like that. The word choice that was used with that in some of these cases, especially like in Proverbs chapter 10, is a Greek word called omphas, or omphak actually. Omphak. And omphak relates to the Hebrew word boser, which is used quite often, meaning the idea of unripe. So it's kind of an interesting spiritual thing here, this object lesson of stuff that's gone sour, gone bad. It's past ripe, but also stuff that is before it's ripened. And you see that in Jeremiah and also in Isaiah, where they basically say, taking things before they are ripe. So it's an interesting thing of not looking for God's timing on things, taking things after they've gone sour, things that have gone sour in your life, but also things that have not even ripened. Kind of not even looking for God's timing in that case. And one of those things that pops up there is in, let's see, that is, that was in, oh yes, unripe grapes. Shows up in Isaiah. Actually, a better passage for this would be Jeremiah 31. We all know Jeremiah 31, but this is kind of an interesting application of this idea of unripeness. And it applies to a spiritual situation we see showing up here in Acts chapter 12. So in Jeremiah 31, one of those passages that we all know quite well here. But skipping down a bit to, let's see here. Ah, yes. It's a very interesting thing about where we have these restoration things. One of the things in Jeremiah 31 is talking about restoration. Now, if you skip down to, verse 28. As I watched over them to pluck up, to break down, to overthrow, to destroy, and to bring disaster, so I will watch over them to build and to plant. So this is something that we saw foretold there in the last few chapters of Deuteronomy, where there would be these blessings for following what God was saying, but also curses that would fall along with that. And there's also the prophecy that after these curses would come down, there would be a time of restoration. So you see a little bit of that coming forward in verse 29. In those days, they will not say again, the fathers have eaten sour grapes. There's that boser, and in Greek, omphok. The fathers have eaten sour grapes, and the children's teeth are set on edge. But everyone will die for his own iniquity. Each man who eats the sour grapes, his teeth will be set on edge. Kind of, it's one of those fun idioms that shows up about teeth being set on edge. I don't know if you've ever, one of the common things that they use now for cooking is unripe grape juice. Something that is actually being sold now instead of vinegar, which is the other way, you've got, verjus? Isn't that what that's called? Yeah, verjus, which is before it's ripe. So it's got that bitterness before and sourness after. Very interesting kind of thing. You see before ripeness, it's bitter, and after ripeness, it's sour. Very interesting idea there. Now, one of those things that we see in this also is the idea about people responsible for their own iniquity. However, this idea of bitterness or the taking things that are bitter before they come ripe also can get passed down from generation to generation, just like what Dave was talking about with, we get grace, we get mercy from God, but there are things that roll down beyond us that really happen because of our doing. One of the key things that we see from that, we see in the life of King David, with things that he did happened to later generations. Things that he did preempting the work of God, also rolling down to later generations. So that brings us back to the idea of unleavened bread. Unleavened bread is talking about sourness, but the idea of sourness also gets applied to things that are before they are ripe, before they've reached their full maturity. Now that's kind of an interesting idea on that sense. The key to this, though, is that in the removal of leaven from this, we get key teachings from Messiah in this regard about leaven, not just malice and wickedness, but maybe specific applications of that. Messiah compares it to hypocrisy. Now, how is hypocrisy a sourness, a point of souring one's spiritual life. Yes.
Really ring true, and there's something going on that's sinful in your life, it will sour you. It will change, even though you try to overcome it with happiness. It will still rain through. It will show itself, whether it be sour or bitter. It's going to come out.
It's also more times than not obvious to others, and it sours them and their, you know, their thoughts toward God.
And toward their fellow man.
Yeah, you saw that in a few cases where Messiah warned his followers that to beware of the leaven. It's talking about the Pharisees. He also refers to the Herod, which is Antipas at that time, his leaven that was coming through, and also the leaven of the Sadducees that was coming through. So hypocrisy, malice, wickedness, all these things in a form of sourness. Now, it's one of those things that we look at. We get this idea of liberty that comes through purging out the malice, the wickedness, the hypocrisy in your life. What is one of the great illustrations that we get of this, unleavened bread and such, in what we read in Acts 12 about Peter and the jail? One of those great sort of, when you talk about the Exodus being a great object lesson, Peter's removal from the jail. Look at some of the details. If you just kind of flip back there to Acts chapter 12, just look at some of the details in this, okay? They really wanted him dead, and this was going to like happen that night. Okay, so definitely this was not a put him in there and forget about him kind of thing. This was a put him in there, make sure he doesn't leave, because we're going to execute him kind of thing. Now, look at how many people they had on him. That was about 16. It was, you know, four groups of four. So they had, and they were talking about some of the details that he was like chained to them and that sort of thing. This idea that they thought they had Peter. He was in a point of weakness. They got him. They were going to get rid of him. But in that point, where it looked like Peter was toast, that very night, going to be dead, locked up, chained up, he had, you know, more of a whole squad, 16 soldiers there around him, yet the chains fall off, and he walks out. Doesn't break out, he walks out. No hurry. Very interesting parallel between Peter's leaving prison and the Exodus itself. I mean, you think about the people of Israel, they were seen to have been overpowered. They didn't have an army. They weren't training regularly to fight. Didn't have chariots and such. And it seemed like there would be no way that God's word to Abraham would come true. Except for one small little detail, I guess Egypt forgot.
I love how he was basically smacked by the angel to, you know, get him up, you know. It makes me want to think I'm married to one because I get smacked all the time.
Glad you had the angel part there, yes, yes.
We're Lord, I'm not yet.
Yes.
Yeah, you've also got them coming out in the same night.
Mm-hmm.
And then also the language of that the angel smiting Peter, the word Pesach, is related to the word to strike. We have mm-hmm. the Meshith, the destroyer. So it's very familiar of that.
Yeah, very.
I've never seen that before.
Definitely not coincidental. Not coincidental. But what should this have showing people. I mean, we see it when we get to Acts 16. We see that with Paul and Silas. That was definitely quite a testimony to the people there. And I believe it was Philippi where he was at that point. It was Philippi. But that was a testimony to the jailer at that point that, whoa, you got to pay attention here. You know, we think that we're overpowering them, and we don't have any power over them.
The thing that always seriously amazed me was, you know, they're praying, oh, God, get this guy out of jail, save him, protect him. They're praying into the wee hours of the night. And God does it and brings them to the very door, to the people that are praying that, and they can't even believe it. But that's the very thing they're praying for, you know? How often have we done that? We've prayed and prayed and prayed, and God does it, and it's like, can't even believe he did it.
Can't even recognize it.
Yeah,
almost.
Can't even recognize it.
And the prayer with passion and ectones, it means to be stretched out earnestly, assiduously. These people were having passionate begging prayer. It wasn't like, oh, please God, deliver him. They were in extremis.
Yeah. Yeah, it's one of the interesting things that David Stern kind of points out in this, of what they were doing, is there's like, you notice there's like five different points of what was happening as they were praying, this kind of intensity. It was not casual, it's not like, okay, let's see, well, before we, let's just throw up, I think Peter's somewhere, he's not a good place, we'll just kind of remember him, throw a line up there and hope it goes somewhere. And it was ongoing. As you can see this in some of these things that we'll read later on, that these prayers were going and going and going and going and going. What was one of the things that Messiah kind of told the parable related to this? Yes. It seems like a very strange parable, because you're like, he's comparing God to some sort of bad judge that can't seem to make up his mind the first time you ask him. What is the interesting lesson out of that, though?
Persistent prayer. Passionate prayer. We haven't even begun to pray yet. I think the days are coming when we'll really learn how to pray. Because when we see one another taken and imprisoned and lives are in danger, then we'll get beyond our embarrassment of weeping and being earnest. I think those days are coming. Yeah.
And it's a very interesting thing because, you know, those who like to equivocate and find, just make things the same. Oh, you know, well, isn't this just the same as what the priests of Baal were doing up there on Mount Carmel, you know, with the Eliyahu? Wasn't it just the same? They're dancing around and praying and screaming all day long and that kind of thing. People could equivocate and say, well, isn't that just kind of the same thing? What?
And passionate faith in a God who is going to answer when you get serious with him. You're not doing things. You're not cutting yourself. You're not trying to make a God, you know, by your own actions other than being completely broken and submissive and subservient. That is a different issue.
Because that, you just pointed out there what the main difference of those cases are.
Well, doing it.
And Eliyahu even pointed this out. It's like, you know, what, is he taking a vacation? Is he going to the John? Where is he when you're calling out for him?
Yeah. But
you have to wake him up versus persistent prayer is happening the other way.
And who the God is, as Richard talked today, he is the God who said, I am, I will be there, howsoever I will be there. That's his name. And if you know him, you know he's going to answer. So you don't have to get hysterical and you don't have to be polite. We have, our prayers are very polite, but with passionate prayer, I think, is what changes things.
Yeah, you see some pretty politically incorrect prayers in the Psalms, which are just born out of just heartfelt grief.
Yeah.
With that, as my wife reminded me, we are not to command either. It is not our place to command pray. And that was an issue that was in our midst not too long ago, but it is a good thing to know who you're praying to. Who are we to command God Almighty?
Yeah, that seems quite presumptuous. I mean, we can't even understand almost a little bit of what he's made, no less how he made it, and here we are, we're going to try to order him around, you know, like we can jerk his chain, do some magic tricks, and he jumps through hoops for us? I don't think so. Yes, which is very interesting that we're talking about this, and we are not God. And one of the things that we had problems with Herod, and we see it right at the end of this chapter, is he's declaring himself to be God. Well, it seems like that little bit of puffiness seemed to have escaped his notice, I guess. Yes, it definitely soured on him.
And how did that turn out for him?
Didn't work too well, no. It definitely bloated and puffed him up. Well, it is time to quit here, but one of the things that it should be quite obvious in this is that the God who was there at the Exodus, the same God who was there here with Peter in prison and going forward. And a lot of what he has to say is just as relevant as it was at the Exodus, as it was there for Peter in prison at that time period and going forward. So these lessons of finding and letting God point out the puffiness, the malice, the wickedness, the hypocrisy in us and remove it is hardly an obsolete and irrelevant lesson that needs to be brought up maybe every year. Let's close in prayer. Father God, we thank you for giving us the testimony of your servants, and we thank you so much for giving us your word so that we don't have to guess at who you are. And you also tell us quite pointedly and repeatedly that you are there. You are there in the past, in the present, in the future. And we thank you for hearing us. Change us. Write your law upon our hearts. We thank you for giving us liberty. Amen.